All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Garanga, Jai Prabhupada. Ma Om Vishnu Padaya, Krishna Stai Bhagavay. Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Saraswati Dem Gauravani Bacharne Nirvishesha Shunyavari Pastucha Deshitarne Jai Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Hare Krishna. So, today's lecture is entitled Beyond Heaven and Hell. It should wake you up a little bit, maybe. I'm going to read a verse to begin with, actually from the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not a Bhagavad Gita verse tonight. This is Srimad Bhagavatam 4:22:56. Gopitaya jagatreste kale sve sve chutatmaka manovagvritabhisham yar gunai samranjayan praja. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Since Maharaj Prithu was a perfect devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he wanted to protect the Lord's creation by pleasing the various citizens according to their various desires. Therefore, Prithu Maharaj used to please them in all respect by his words, mentality, works, and gentle behavior. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The word achyutatmaka is significant in this verse, for Maharaj Prithu used to rule this planet as the representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He knew that he was the representative of the Lord, and the Lord's creation must be protected intelligently. Atheists cannot understand the purpose behind the creation. Although this material world is condemned when it is compared to the spiritual world, there is still some purpose behind it. Modern scientists and philosophers cannot understand that purpose, nor do they believe in the existence of a creator. They try to establish everything by their so-called scientific research, but they do not center anything around the Supreme Creator. A devotee, however, can understand the purpose of this creation, which is to give facility to the individual living entities who want to lord it over material nature. The ruler of this planet should therefore know that all the inhabitants, especially human beings, have come to this material world for sense enjoyment. It is therefore the duty of the ruler to satisfy them in their sense enjoyment, but as well to elevate them to Krishna consciousness so they can all ultimately return home back to Godhead. So I sort of selected this, particularly this purport of Srila Prabhupada's, where he talks about the purpose of creation. I think it's a very basic concept, but it's a very interesting concept to think about. Why is it that we're here? What is the purpose? What is the plan? What plan does God have for the creation of this material world, for all of us being here? And what greater purpose does it serve? Now, of course, philosophers and religionists have thought about these questions for many, many years, hundreds if not thousands of years, and there are many different answers that are there. And I would say that the different religions of the world grapple with this question of what is actually the purpose of life, what is the destination, and specifically, why is this material world created in the way that it is? And this brings up the question of good and evil. Why do we see that there is good and seemingly evil in this world? What is the destination of those whose behavior is exemplified by both good and evil, or as the Bhagavad Gita says in the 16th chapter, the divine and demoniac nature? I was thinking about this question particularly in relationship to a new book that's out that's actually a bestseller now. Now, it's kind of an interesting book to be on the bestseller list. It's not your typical spy thriller or murder mystery or whatever. It's actually a book by an evangelical preacher named Rob Bell. And he's one of these, very charismatic, members of these mega churches with thousands of members. He's kind of young, dynamic, very charismatic, has a big following. He really was considered an up-and-coming, rising star of this evangelical movement. But he's kind of really surprised his fellow evangelicals by a book that he's written that takes quite a different look at things. The book he's written is called Love Wins, a book about heaven, hell, and the fate of every person who ever lived. That's the title, Beyond Heaven and Hell, of this lecture today. Now, what was interesting about this was he takes a little different course than many of his brethren in this field. Apparently, his thought process started when he did an art show, an art exhibit about peace in his local church. And his local church, as I said, is 7,000 members, so it's a huge community. And in one of the exhibits, he had a quotation from Mahatma Gandhi about peace. Okay, makes sense. Be a normal, you know, good person to probably find a good quote from. And one of the people in his congregation wrote this note, kind of scrawled it right on the placard or whatever, said, by the way, Gandhi is in hell. And so he started to think about this. He says, why is Gandhi in hell? Are we sure that he's in hell? Do we have scriptural evidence for that? Is this actually part of our belief system and philosophy? And so he began to think about this idea of who is actually redeemed, you know, who is punished, who is rewarded. And he actually very honestly felt, as Christians, he says, can we say that anyone who is not a Christian is in hell? I mean, obviously, from any objective standpoint, just in terms of, well, what we think of as terms of karma or pious activity, you know, Gandhi was a pretty good person. I mean, we had some, you know, Srila Prabhupada had some objections to his emphasis more on the political than the spiritual, but obviously, in many ways, he led a good life. He wouldn't be the kind of person that most would say, there's somebody going to hell, you know. But from this very strict, fundamental conception, someone had concluded that because, you know, he was not a member of the Christian faith, that he was surely going to hell. So in Rob Bell's book, he actually promotes a concept of universal salvation or universal redemption. He is saying that heaven must certainly be more open, you know, a little bit more open-door policy than just those who are of a particular creed or a particular faith, and he is more or less saying that anybody has an opportunity to go to heaven. And of course, the philosophical issue is that, first of all, two points really. One, the idea that can people of other faiths achieve salvation or achieve the end goal of spiritual life, or is it restricted to a very small minority of individuals? You know, and he was saying that even if one took the tack that, well, yes, you must be a Christian, therefore it's our Christian duty to go out and missionary work throughout the world, make sure that everybody's Christians. And he makes the point in this book, apparently, he says, what if the missionary had a flat tire, didn't get to that village, and those people are all condemned, you know, to eternity for hell because the missionary didn't make it there. So first of all, there's the logical inconsistency that only a small group of people who were fortunate enough to be born in a particular country in a particular historical epoch of time could have salvation. And then there's a second philosophical point. And that's the point of how do you reconcile eternal damnation with a God of love? If God is the all-loving Father, and of course Jesus as his Son came to preach this message of love, how is it that God could condemn, you know, entire nations, entire generations of people to eternal damnation? So this is a real problem sometimes for people trying to understand this type of theology. But there's another side to it, and that's the side that many of his critics have stated. And that side is, well, if there is no hell and everybody can go to heaven, then what is the motivation? What is the impetus for anybody to behave properly? In other words, if there's no real restriction, if there's no reaction to sinful life, then why not just do anything? Why should anybody even bother with religion? Why not just live life the best you can, have a good time? That's the end of it. We're all going to be saved anyway. You know, so you can see that it's really a dilemma. It's a real dilemma for religionists. Because actually, if our purpose of life is only personal sense gratification, and we do whatever we please, whatever seems to be satisfactory to the person at the time, then we have this very relativistic concept. What would be the meaning of morality and ethics? What to speak of what would be the meaning of the greater questions of developing spiritual life or understanding God and one's relationship with God? What would be the purpose of even doing that? If everything is going to be fine, you enjoy life here, and at the end you go to heaven. Sounds like a good deal. Not, you know, very, no commitment needed. And the problem is, it's not just that people would lead a good life and then go back to heaven. Many people would not do that. We would have the problem of those who are greedy, those who are exploitative, those who wanted to gain control, power, to abuse others. What would stop a person? What would be the moral imperative? Not to, what to speak of, kill animals, to kill other people, commit abortion, kill children in the womb, commit wars, try to get ahead in whatever way you could. Usually it's found that there needs to be some moral disincentive for people to act in such ways. There needs to be some sort of socialization that brings people to higher behavior and higher understanding. So this is the problem. You would have this sort of unleashed, you know, atheism and sinful activity. And, of course, even the Bhagavad Gita talks about this. 16.8 says, this is Krishna talking about the demoniac mentality or the atheistic mentality. Krishna says, they say that this world is unreal, with no foundation and no God in control. They say it is produced of sex desire and has no cause other than lust. In other words, there's no real meaning to life. There's no real purpose. Everything is just based upon, nothing is real. Therefore, do whatever one wants to do to try to, you know, to gain, to get ahead. Can I get some water from somebody? Thank you. So we have a philosophical quandary here. We have two issues here. One is the necessity to have, you know, to have some sort of, there's this innate feeling that many, many people just have because it's actually our nature, because we are actually part and parcel of God. We actually have an innate nature and need to serve God and to please God. So there is that, you know, that need that human society has to promote good behavior, you know, to eliminate sinful activity, to try to curb the sort of animalistic impulses of human beings to create a religious, civilized society. On the other hand, there's also this idea, thank you very much, you know, of God as a loving father, or this idea of redemption, of rectification, that there can be some, you know, universal salvation for people. Now, you won't be surprised to know that where I'm going with this is Krishna consciousness has the solution to this issue. which is a very thorny problem for people of many different religions, of how to reconcile these two things. You know, how do we reconcile the fact that there is punishment for wrongdoing in this world, but at the same time that God is a loving father and his representatives, incarnations, avatars, are seen as instruments of love, of liberation, of salvation, of universal peace, hope, and all of these good qualities? Well, we can understand from our scriptures, from the Vedic literature, that there's really two purposes for this material world, which encompass both of these problems or questions. First of all, this is a place of punishment, so to speak. Prabhupada often likened the material world to a prison house. So those rebellious souls who did not want to serve God need a place to go. In the spiritual world, everyone is serving Krishna. Everyone is loving Krishna. If you don't want to serve and love Krishna, it's not the place for you. You don't fit in. You know, you need another place. So Krishna provided that place. It's called the material world. Here we are. There is this entire universe created actually for really one reason: as a place for those rebellious living entities to come and try to fulfill their material desires. Those who want to have life without God, without service, without spiritual understanding. Here it is. We have this opportunity to try to act as though we were God, act as though we are the controller, that we are, you know, master of all that we survey, and that everything is here for our enjoyment rather than for the enjoyment of the Lord. Now, that comes with a price, unfortunately, or fortunately. And that price is that there is reaction for sinful activity. For every action, you know, there's a equal reaction. That's the law of karma that we understand from the Vedic literatures. Without this understanding of the laws of karma and the laws of reincarnation and transmigration of the soul, it's very difficult to understand the process of how things are working in the material world. It actually doesn't make a lot of sense. Even beyond the question of punishment for those who are sinful, even the question of how your action in one lifetime would determine your entire future for all eternity somehow doesn't seem fair, does it? In other words, I slip up a little bit, or I'm not born in the right family or in the right country, you know, then that determines my destiny for all time. There's kind of a logical issue, and I mean, it sort of innately does not feel like a very fair or just system. Then there's the problem of evil and the problem of, you know, why is it? In fact, stepping back a minute, I mean, about 20 years ago, there was another famous religious book that made the bestseller list. Some of you probably have heard of it. It was a rabbi wrote, and it was called something like Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? Remember that? I think we got a lot of mileage in Bhagavatam classes out of that one, too. You know, it was because it posed another one of these problems that's very difficult for Western religious traditions to solve. In other words, people seem like they're good people, they're leading a good life, and their children die, or they get cancer, or they're killed early in a car accident. Why? There seems to be no reason. It's not just that people committing sinful activity, we see bad things happening to, they all get killed or get diseases or whatever. No. Sometimes they seem to be enjoying quite well and maybe wealthy and, you know, seem to be having a good life. Where others who seem to be more pious and leading a good life, sometimes all sorts of things may happen to them or reactions happen to them. Again, if we don't understand these laws of karma, transmigration, it's very difficult to figure these things out. They really don't make a lot of sense. So fortunately, the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedas very clearly spell this out in a way that makes it's not only that it makes logical sense, but it's satisfying to the inner needs of the soul. Because these are the things that we innately, inherently understand at some level. And of course, we may not fully understand these concepts of knowledge until that knowledge is reawakened within us by the spiritual master and by the Vedas. It's described that the spiritual master, the guru, is like the father, the Vedas are like the mother. So when the Vedas, the spiritual master there, like the father and mother, then the seed of knowledge is implanted and comes forth. So fortunately, when we have that knowledge, these things can become much more clear. So we can understand that there is a purpose of this material world. The material world is here as a place where those living entities who are rebellious have a place to come. But it has a second purpose as well. It also has that purpose of a place of reformation and rectification. Just like in an ideal world, a prison would be a place of reformation where a person would, you know, perhaps learn some new skills, learn not to be a criminal, and come out and be a good, productive member of society. Of course, we know today that most people go to prison, they learn criminal skills better, right? You know, it becomes a good place to learn that. You know, but nevertheless, in an ideal world, that would be the situation. So it's meant, this material world is meant to give a chance for the conditioned souls to be able to live according to religious principles in this life, and then through the process of jagya, the process of sacrifice, and the process of jnana, the process of knowledge, and ultimately by the process of bhakti, of loving devotional service to Krishna, we can realize our true nature and be able to get out of this material world. So Krishna gives us an opportunity to actually not simply suffer the punishment of this material world, but to live in a peaceful way in this material world and then be able to get out, to be able to actually find our true spiritual knowledge, find our true identity, and be able to get out of this cycle of birth and death. So in a purport to the Bhagavad Gita 3.10, Śrīla Prabhupāda explains this. He says, "The Lord created this material world to enable the conditioned souls to learn how to perform jagya sacrifice for the satisfaction of Vishnu, so that while in the material world, They can live very comfortably without anxiety. And after finishing the present material body, they can enter into the kingdom of God. That is the whole program for the conditioned soul. So that's explained right there. That is our program. Live peacefully according to religious practices in this world, and then to be able to get out of this world to go back home, back to Godhead. By performance of jagya, the conditioned souls gradually become Krishna conscious and become godly in all respects. So that helps us to understand the purpose of this material creation and the purpose of why we are here, why we are sometimes are suffering, and what is the meaning behind this. And we can also understand through the laws of karma and transmigration how the conditioned soul experiences different results, both good and bad, pious and impious, as a result of those activities. Now, what about the question of heaven and hell? We can understand that designations of heaven and hell are simply different conditions of material life. Sometimes we are in higher conditions of material life, more elevated, more pious, with greater ability for enjoyment, and sometimes we are in lower positions, more degraded positions in this material world. Heaven and hell can also not just be distinct planets. Of course, we know from the Bhagavatam that there are heavenly planets, different planetary systems, and that there are lower planetary systems. We talk about the three planetary systems. The higher, the lower, the middle planetary system. Earth is a middle planet. Earth is neither particularly heavenly, particularly enjoyable, nor is it particularly hellish or terrible. But it occupies that middle ground, which is actually considered to be beneficial for spiritual life because we can understand both. But besides just being different planetary systems, we can also understand heaven and hell being states of being or different states that one might obtain by one's activity. So different bodies that we may experience. Another thing, many religions think that we are only in a human form of life, and think that the animals or plants have no soul. But we can understand that Krishna is the seed-giving father of all living entities. We can understand that all living entities possess eternal spiritual nature. So in some bodies, one may experience a very hellish condition. In certain animal bodies, we can see how much suffering is there. And then sometimes we can see that some people, even on this planet, seem to have almost a heavenly planet existence, where they're very wealthy and famous and have all the comforts that they could possibly have. So those conditions can be there even within this particular planet, more heavenly or more hellish conditions. So are we very concerned about heaven and hell and where these different destinations are? Not really so much. Why? Because the Bhagavad Gita in the 8th chapter says, Abrahma Bhuvana Loka Pranarja Partinorjuna. From the highest planet in this material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery, wherein repeated birth and death take place. The one who attains my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. So all of this discussion and debate going on within the Christian community about is there hell and what are the results and who goes to hell and who doesn't go to hell are really not quite as relevant to the devotees, because we can understand that everyone is experiencing their reaction, their karma, their experience because of their pious and impious activities. And that whether one is going to a more heavenly or to a more hellish situation, these situations are all temporary. Heaven and hell are not eternal destinations for the soul. They are simply temporary positions where one is enjoying not enjoying the reaction of one's past activities. So for the devotee, these things are less important because we understand that the material world is more or less constant in the fact, as stated in this verse, that repeated birth and death take place. There's no permanent situation. Even in the highest planetary systems, even Lord Brahma must die, even after it's 311 trillion years. It's still, even if it's a very, very long time, but also remember that in the heavenly planets, time is very relative. Time is a material phenomena. And so it's very relative. 100 years of the demigods is experienced much like 100 years on the planet Earth. It goes by fairly quickly. And one thing you'll notice, I noticed that probably the large majority of people in this room are quite a bit younger than I am, But what happens as you get older is that time seems to move very quickly. You know, it's before you know it, a few more years are gone, a few more years are gone, and you look around, and all of a sudden you thought you were young, and then all of a sudden you're not. It comes about very quickly, very suddenly. You know, but there is an advantage to it. Well, there's a couple advantages, really. You know, besides the fact that your senses subdue a little bit and perhaps you become a little bit more thoughtful. But even if those things don't happen, at the very least, you begin to see the mortality of the body, and you begin to see that we are not here forever. And just as all situations are temporary, even these planets are temporary, all bodily situations are not permanent. And therefore, it behooves us to find out what is our real interest in life. What is our real position? If these bodies are temporary, if all of our situations are temporary, what is it that we need to focus upon? We need to focus upon that which is eternal, and that is the pure spirit soul which is within this body. And we need to focus upon the nature of that soul, which is to be eternal, full of knowledge, and full of bliss. And we need to function upon the eternal occupation or duty of the spirit soul, which is eternal servant of Krishna. So with that knowledge of the Vedas and from coming from the spiritual master, one understands one's real position in life. And when one understands that position, which is spiritual in nature and has nothing to do with this material body and mind, what is the result? One is peaceful. One is happy. One is content. No more hankering or lamenting. No more trying to figure out how can I get a better situation, how can I get more in this life, because what does it mean? Prabhupada said this material world is like a phantasmagoria, although it feels very real to us most of the time. But the fact is, when we're a little bit more insightful, with spiritual knowledge, we understand the fleeting nature of this material world and the fleeting nature of the sensory enjoyment that is available to these bodies within the material world. And therefore, we try to understand what our real purpose is and to act according to that purpose. Spiritual life is not simply a mental platform. It is not something that is just based upon some theoretical intellectual understanding. Spiritual life is practical. Spiritual life is very real. Spiritual life is based on action. And that action is, of course, is acts of devotional service, of bhakti. So through that practical practice of bhakti yoga, one understands one's spiritual nature, acts in that nature, and then becomes free from these designations of the material world and becomes situated on the spiritual platform. So at the point of leaving this material world, this material body, we will not have to come back again. So that action that's necessary in bhakti is prescribed for us. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come and given us the chanting of the holy name. Continue a little further in that purport of Bhagavad Gita 3.10, it talks about jagya and talks about, and of course, that sacrifice for Vishnu must be performed. Srila Prabhupada concludes that purport by saying, in the age of Kali, the Sankirtan Jagya, the chanting of the names of God, is recommended by the Vedic scriptures. And this transcendental system was introduced by Lord Chaitanya for the deliverance of all men in this age. Sankirtan Jagya and Krishna consciousness go well together. So we're very, very fortunate to be given entry to this Sankirtan movement, this chanting of the holy name by Srila Prabhupada. So we're very, very fortunate to be in this movement that Srila Prabhupada started for the salvation of all souls, so we don't have to worry about our salvation. We're not so much concerned about heaven and hell and what our destination might be, but we are very concerned for all living entities, for the conditioned souls, because we understand that everyone is suffering this material world. And just as we have received the spiritual knowledge, which allows us to become free from repeated birth and death through the chanting of the holy name and the propagation of Sankirtan Jagya, we can also give that great mercy of the Lord to all other living entities. Right. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. So we have a few minutes, perhaps, if there's any questions or comments from anyone. Everyone is either very convinced or asleep. Probably asleep. Yes, bro. Yes. And what's wrong with it? Yeah. It's a very good question. Is asking, you know, many people who are very immersed in material life, they don't even really understand the concept of sense gratification. How do you get these understandings across to people? Actually, that's true, because people, by and large, identify so much with the body that to not identify with the body and the gratification of the body is a totally foreign principle. It almost doesn't make sense to them. You know, that they, it's like you say, if you say this is wrong, they don't even get it. Like, why would it be? Isn't that the purpose? We're here, I have this body, what purpose does it have other than to try to enjoy? Sometimes it is very difficult, and, you know, sometimes prasadam and hearing the holy name is the best thing we can do for people. But I've noticed that one thing that people can usually understand is the principle of suffering. Most people, if they're honest, can understand that not only is there certain pleasure and enjoyment and sense gratification in this body, but along with that, you have to accept the whole package. And that whole package includes suffering. And even people say, I'm having a good time, I'm not suffering. They can, if they have a little bit, if they're not totally covered over, they can understand that old age, disease, and death will be coming even for them. You know, and everybody has to endure that. Everyone has to experience that. Your situation will come to an end. And sometimes people can become a little more thoughtful, you know, and think about that. And then we try to present, just as Srila Prabhupada did, you know, would always say, make a solution to the real problems of life. Real problems of life are birth, death, disease, and old age. Make a real solution, a permanent solution. That's how to get out of this material world. Now, of course, not everybody's going to understand. Not everyone's going to accept. And therefore, sometimes the best we can do is try to, you know, give prasadam, chanting, whatever way we can engage some in devotional service so that their heart becomes purified and then they'll be able to hear. You know, but just having your association, having the association of devotees and, you know, whatever you can do to help purify them, if not in this lifetime, the next lifetime, there'll be some benefit. One thing that we have to always think about is that somehow or another, whoever I'm running into has been given the opportunity to meet a devotee, Hare Krishna. So there's some reason, there's some opportunity there. But it's not always easy to get people to understand this philosophy. Anything else? All glories to Srila Prabhupada.